is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. This week, a 63-year-old Mike Melville became the first person to be launched into space, not by a government, but by a private company. The Spaceship One launch by the company Scaled Composites, backed by investment from Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, may be a first step in opening up space travel to ordinary people. Joining me now is NPR science correspondent David Kestenbaum, who was at Monday's launch in the Mojave Desert. Welcome.
Hi, Ira.
Describe the experience for us, David.
Well, it was pretty remarkable. Have you ever been to Mojave?
No, I have not been to that desert.
It's sort of at a crossroads between Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, and some people there hope it's going to become another kind of, you know, Vegas. But it's really a lot of fast food places right now, and this airport, which is pretty remarkable. It's used a lot for experimental vehicles and to store. It's where old airplanes go to die.
Uh-huh.
If you walk around, there are scraps of a bit of a wing here, you know, a wheel there, and these runways. And then in the distance, maybe you saw on television, there are actually commercial airplanes that are just sort of parked there because it's cheap parking. Mm-hmm. So it was very un-NASA-like in that, the briefing room, for starters, where, you know, we got all our information, the chairs were actually from airplanes. And they had tray tables in back and little recliner buttons in them. And when Bert Rutan, who's the lead engineer, and this was his baby, this thing, stood up and he introduced all his, you know, his engineers, there were only about maybe a dozen people or so standing behind him. And they all looked like they'd never looked into a camera really before. They all looked a little kind of uncomfortable. And, you know, when you stop to think about it, it was a little scary. When we were standing out on the runway, I heard one of the officials saying, he was talking about the audio between sort of mission control and the pilots. And he said to the guy who was in charge of it, he said, you know, keep in mind, if something goes wrong, you yank it. I mean, so they were worried that there was something
happen. So you could hear during the whole flight, the air to ground. And
yeah, it wasn't very clear. I don't think I could really make out any of it. But, you know, in the back of people's minds was the possibility something would go wrong.
But it didn't.
It didn't. It was, it began with there's this mother craft called the White Knight that it gets its start on. It's tied to the underbelly of it. And that rolled down the runway. And it didn't, you think it would stop for pictures, but it was just, you know, all business. It went down the runway, it turned around, went back, took off. And then you could watch it spiral up for a while. And it was a clear day. And then it went up for about an hour to 48,000 feet. And at that point, Spaceship One with the pilot, Mike Melville, which was in the belly of this thing, detached and took off. And you could see this contrail. It just went straight up. And then it was silent for a while, and you were sort of guessing what had happened. And then the announcer said everything seemed to be okay. And a while later, he reappeared there on the runway. And, you know, unlike with NASA, where they might keep it away from you. You certainly have to be a long way away from the space shuttle when it launches. We were right next to the runway, and you could see his little hand sticking out of the doorway. The spaceship itself is very small. His little hand stuck out, and then he climbed out. Yeah. And eventually, at one point, he stood on top of the thing, and he was just so excited. There's obviously, you know, adrenaline was just running through him.
Was there a real sense that there was history being made here? The senior prom, you know.
The prom king. Yeah, it was like somewhere in between those two. The problem is once you start trying to scale this up, if you want to take big heavy loads up, then you really end up again with something like the space shuttle, and you end up dealing with difficult problems like reentry and the thermal protection system and how to deal with the blistering, you know, 1,000-degree temperatures. And so, you know, he really poked his head out in space and came back down. But, you know, and it still sounded like a great trip.
And, you know, some people have compared it to what would have happened if the Wright brothers had been around today and done their flight with people watching. You know, do you think it might be something like this in a, you know, very small scale? You know, maybe like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak with their computer in the garage, you know, getting their first PC going there.
It is remarkable that they invited people. They must have been pretty confident because, you know, had things gone wrong, this would have been a very bad first step for commercial spaceflight. But I feel like they'd flown it up to 40 miles before, and they were taking it up to 63 this time. So they feel like they from an engineering perspective, they'd tested it in the ways that were important.
And the people who were there, were they more like Star Trekkies or were they, you know, just the average folks coming?
I was expecting that, but the night before, they allowed people to camp out on the, you know, one of these big lots at the airport. And I walked around, and it was incredibly windy, and there were, I don't know, maybe 100 RVs and tents, and I went around and talked to people. A lot of them, people were there with their kids. A lot of them were pilots, you know, who were big fans of Burt Rutan or anything like this, and a bunch of them were engineers. So I didn't see a lot of the Star Trek crowd there, but I was sitting next to a guy on the plane on the way out there who, on the other hand, was reading a book about Nikolai Tesla, the physicist, and the Nazis and how they had a secret spaceship program and it was all being covered up. So, and there certainly were people at the who'd gone there for the launch who are quite angry with NASA, who feel like, you know, they'd been promised there'd be moon colonies now and they'd be able to take their girlfriends up for dates. And they feel like that just hasn't happened. There was one someone had a sign that said Spaceship One, Government Zero. And I thought that sort of summed it up.
All right. Did they say what, you know, is the X Prize next? Are they going for that? What's new? What's up for Spaceship One on this?
Burt Rutan says, you know, they clearly intend to win it if they can. He said they needed sort of a 60-day lead time to be able to do that. What they need to do is send three people up, or the weight equivalent of three people up, and bring the craft back down, and then do that again within 2 weeks. And he said he'd been planning on being able to do three flights within 2 weeks, so he didn't seem worried about his ability to do it. And the pilot said, "Make no doubt about it, we will win the X Prize." So he does have some competitors there, and it's possible they could sneak in. But Burt Rutan seems to be in the lead.
Well, we had Paul Allen on the show last week, and he said that he definitely wants to go in this ship up into space.
Oh, really? That's interesting, because he was asked, you know, would you fly up? And he didn't really answer the question. He said, "Well, there are a lot of issues." You know, I mean, that's now the questions that need to be asked about this are the basic business 101 questions you would ask if you were launching a new shampoo. You know, like, what's the cost going to be? If it's $100,000, if it's $10,000 a seat, that's one thing. You know, if it's $100,000, then really only the fairly well-off are going to be able to do it. And if it's risky, then you're into the well-off and risk-taker crowd, which is much smaller. If it's $10,000 a seat and it's safe and you get sort of an hour up there, I could imagine a lot more people would be interested. But I think it really comes down to how it shakes out from a business point of view.
Well, we'll have to watch and wait. And I want to thank you very much, David.
Thanks, Ira.
And hope there are a lot more launches for you to go see and report for us. David Kestenbaum, science correspondent for NPR in Washington. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about some of those issues that David raised and some of the issues about the success of Spaceship One. What does it mean? Was it really a door opening for a fledgling space industry? Will it turn out to be, in retrospect, maybe just a publicity stunt and goes nowhere? Or could it be, as I mentioned, brought up akin to the Wright brothers' first flight? Maybe the door is open now to the commercialization of space. And can NASA and private companies work together? Last week, the President's Commission on Implementation of the United States Space Exploration Policy issued its final report to the president. And the commission said that, quote, fundamental changes must take place in how the nation approaches space exploration and manages the vision for success. This national effort calls for a transformation of NASA, building a robust international space industry, a discovery-based science agenda, and educational initiatives to support youth and teachers inspired by the vision. Does this sound like 1957 all over again? The education part, the, you know, rejiggering up NASA. NASA was created for the space race in the 60s. Or what? Are we going to be just now going in the opposite direction, as this commission suggests, and possibly farming out a lot of what the government does to private industry? Yesterday, NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe announced some of the first steps of that transformation. He unveiled a new organizational chart to reform NASA into comply with what he views as the way NASA should be going in the future. And while the commissioners said they supported President Bush's proposed Moon to Mars space exploration policy, some outside observers said the report didn't offer enough specifics about how the goals would be accomplished. Lofty ideals, a vision, but how do we get from A to B to C, and who's going to pay for it and stuff like that? So we'll be talking about this report, its proposals, how do we get from here to there. What do you think about where we should be heading in space? Should the federal government welcome private space efforts, as it might be appearing to be heading in that direction? Should it just get out of the space business, let private industry get in on it? How much should the federal government be involved? How much should space industry be involved? We're going to talk about that with our guests. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Maria Zuber is a member of the Presidential Commission. She's also the head of the department and E.A. Griswold Professor of Geophysics in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences at MIT. She joins us from the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Ira.
Thank you. Dr. Elagar Sadeh is an assistant professor in the Space Studies Department, part of the Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. He joins us by phone from his office there. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Sadeh.
Thank you, Arvin.
You're welcome. Elon Musk, he's the chairman and CEO of Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, SpaceX. They're based in El Segundo, California. He joins us by phone from there. Welcome to the program, Elon.
Thank you.
You were at the Space One launch yourself yesterday, were you not, Elon? Monday?
I was, yeah. In fact, I was there on Sunday and Monday. And I'm one of the people providing financial support to the XPRIZE.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big supporter of that whole program, and I have a tremendous amount of admiration for what Bert Rattan and Paul Allen as the financier have achieved.
Do you think this is the Wright brothers flight, or is this more of a publicity stunt?
You know, I'm not sure. I think it may be somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
I think certainly. A lot of the criticisms I've seen of this flight are not really valid, because I think if one were to criticize the Wright brothers' flight, there was a lot to criticize. I mean, that was not a useful airplane,
mm-hmm.
But it nonetheless it heralded the dawn of aviation. And I think at least to some degree, the flight of Spaceship One heralds the dawn of a new era of space exploration.
Mm-hmm. Maria Zuber, do you agree?
Well, it's certainly an important step. It remains to be seen how it's going to play out, but it's certainly something that is long overdue and needed to occur. And however it shakes out, it was an important step.
Mm-hmm. As one of the commissioners on this panel, do you think that we're now at a turning point in the space industry where we're going to be seeing more private industry taking over where the government had been?
Well, we were compelled in our analysis that the time had come for more commercial involvement. It really remains to be seen, what it's going to take for this to be commercially viable. But, when we started our analysis and President Bush had called for rejuvenating the human space exploration program, and, with just a small increment in the budget, it was fairly clear that the path to success was going to be to try to get as many people as possible involved. And certainly we heard a lot of testimony that indicated that the private sector was willing and interested in participating.
Mm-hmm. But part of the criticism has been that it just doesn't really lay out in detail any steps.
Well, first of all, the president gave us 120 days, which is not a long period of time, to chart the course of what is really a very ambitious goal that consists of robots, humans, low Earth orbit, the Moon, Mars, and it was clear that no small panel of experts could sit down in 120 days. And define all of the steps for what's the proper sequence, what's the kind of launch vehicles that would be required. And so what we
hold that thought, because I have to rudely interrupt. We have to take a break, so stay with us. We'll be back with our guests in just a moment. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about the role of private industry in space exploration and about the reconfiguration of NASA with my guests, Maria Zuber, member of the President's Commission on the Implementation of the U.S. Space Exploration Policy. She's also head of the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences at MIT. Allegra Sade, assistant professor in the Space Studies Department at University of North Dakota. Elon Musk, chairman of and CEO of SpaceX. And when I rudely interrupted Dr. Zuber, she was telling us that you really didn't have much time to put a full report together, I'm suspecting.
Well, it's not that we didn't have time to put a full report together. We actually spent quite a bit of time analyzing this. We decided that our chairman thought we should write a 50-page report as opposed to a 500-page report because everybody could read it, and that if we had written a 400-page appendix to our 50-page report with lots of detail in it, I'm sure we would have been criticized for being overly prescriptive on how to implement a program of that complexity. I think the most positive thing that has come out of this report so far is the fact that this nation really needed a dialogue about what the future of space exploration should be, and we've written a short report with a number of findings and a number of recommendations, and as we had hoped, a lot of people have read that report, and it's certainly getting a lot of attention.
Dr. Sade, the dialogue has begun. What is your take on this?
No, I think it's very positive. I think the report is actually very laudable. It really sets not only a new agenda for NASA, but also a new agenda for space commerce, and I think really what's the key, I think, you know, it's not an either-or proposition. I don't think it's either government space or space from the private sector, but it's a partnership between the two. And I really think the report lays out some suggestions and recommendations that really tie into the natural synergy between the government and the commercial and private sector. The idea being that the government is in a position to actually take the risks for space exploration so that those risks can be reduced, so that commercial private sector can actually make money, can make a return on their investments. So I think the idea of trying to, you know, build upon and enhance that vision is very important, and NASA's recent announcement and reorganization of creating mission areas, one for exploration and one for space operations, and letting commerce deal more with operations and NASA taking the lead in exploration fits very well within that synergy.
Elon Musk, what do you need as a private entrepreneur from the government so that you'll be encouraged to continue as an entrepreneur into space?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think the report was great, by the way, and actually I was one of the people that testified before the Presidential Commission. There are a couple of things that I really like about it, and I think that could be very encouraging to commercialization of space and really invigorating the whole space sector. The biggest being this notion of prizes. NASA has a program which today is quite small called the Centennial Prize Program, and I believe the Commission recommended substantially extending that program and perhaps having prizes which are quite significant, perhaps as much as $100 or $200 million for being able to repeat the John Glenn flight. So it would be sort of an orbital version of the X Prize. I think something like that could be just tremendous.
Do you have the backing that you could put a man in or a woman into orbit like John Glenn? It would take, you know, so much money to do that.
Oh yeah, I'm quite confident that SpaceX could achieve such a goal. It would be quite an expensive proposition, and it would be very helpful if there were a prize at the end of the day for that, because I don't think that there's any individual out there. Unless perhaps it's Paul Allen, who wishes to pay $200 million to achieve that goal.
And what is the commercial value of being able to do that?
Well, I think the initial commercial value is limited, and that's why a prize can be very helpful in buying down the R&D necessary to achieve that goal. However, once that R&D is bought down, it's possible that we could start off with orbital flights, which are perhaps a few million dollars a person, assuming you don't have to pay back that R&D expense, and then you try to establish some sort of a Moore's law of space transportation, where every year it gets lower and lower. I mean, you often see analogies drawn to the computer industry, where you know, we started off with these mainframes that could only be afforded, only large corporations and governments could afford them, and they took up entire rooms and all that sort of thing. Then we went to mini computers, then we went to desktops, now laptops, now you're your cell phone has more computing power than the Saturn V moon rocket did.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone can afford a computer today. And so, but in order for that, for us to eventually reach that goal, we have to set space transportation on a path of continuous improvement. It is not that way today.
Mm-hmm. One of the recommendations that was made in this report, and I think it's quite telling, is that you have to come up with a policy, and the administration has to develop, the public has to develop a fact, quote, that make it relevant to all Americans so that they accept the ownership of this program. Because it's going to have to go. It's a very long-term idea going through decades. It'll have to go from one administration to the other. What is to say that come November, if President Bush is not reelected, this whole thing gets scrapped? This whole idea. How do you create that feeling? I know it's a little bit interesting to say, you know, to a country that sent a person to the men to the moon, and now we have to re-interest people in space travel, so they own it.
Well, this is one of the things that we spent a great deal of time talking about, was the requirement that that this entire program be owned by the American people. And as part of our research, we talked to a lot of people in the country, and there were an awful lot of people that we spoke to who went into technical fields, science, engineering, etc., most of whom didn't wind up working for NASA or for aerospace contractors, but who got the bug, essentially, being excited about space exploration, and went on with it. So there's actually, we think, fairly broad support, but the support has to be such that it passes between one presidential administration to the next presidential administration, through various Congresses and through generations of American taxpayers.
1-800-989-8255, our number. Let's go to Aaron in Mason, Michigan. Hi, Aaron.
Hello, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. It seems to me, I keep hearing the word used is space exploration, and we need to start talking about colonization, frankly, in my mind, because the whole point of us sending people out there is to actually go out there to live. That's why, I mean, that's the whole point of having cheap access to space, because ultimately, if we're just interested in finding out what's there, we can use robots. But if you're going to send people up in space, it's going to be for colonization. So why aren't we talking about colonization? You know, how close are we to it? And I have a specific question to Dr. Zubra. How much did the commission talk about colonization, or didn't it really touch on that subject?
Okay, well, I can address that. Certainly, the commission believes that there's a great deal that can be done in exploration using robotic methods, which are certainly more cost-effective. And the conclusion of the commission was actually that wherever one can use a robot to achieve the goals, the particular space exploration goals, one ought to use robots and humans should be used for tasks and for situations that robots couldn't be used for. So to be quite clear, we're not talking about humans just going up for the sake of going up and taking over tasks that could be done more easily by robots, because certainly from the standpoint of doing science,
but what
you want to get as much...
is what I'm saying.
Okay, well, colonization is something that goes further out, and we did address that in the report from the standpoint of posing the question, what is it going to take for humans to live off planet? Okay, and in order, we are not in a position to answer that question right now, because to answer that question, we need to have a better idea of the resources in space that are available and the accessibility of those resources, because the biggest cost in space is getting out of the gravity well of Earth, and weight is cost, and basically, if you want to be able to survive off planet, you don't want to have to take everything with you, okay? Mm-hmm. And you need to use the resources that are in space.
Is it going to be NASA's job to colonize space or to set up colonies on the moon, or is that going to be a private industry's commercial venture in the commission's viewpoint?
Well, I think we're looking a far ways away. Okay, for the case of if we go further out, for the case of Mars, it is very clear that Mars has abundant resources and it has easily accessible resources. You know, in the last from the robotic missions over the last 5 years or so, the discovery of just vast amounts of water in the frozen state within a meter of the surface has been a real boon to the idea that we can eventually send people to Mars and have them survive there for a long period of time, because we know that this water is accessible. You need a hot plate to melt it. It's right there. You need a shovel and a hot plate to access that. On the moon, there is there has been detections in the last number of years of hydrogen near the surface. We don't know whether that hydrogen is in the form of water. It's in shaded craters, permanently shaded craters near the lunar poles. If it is near the surface and if it is in the frozen water state, then that makes it accessible. If it turns out it's just hydrogen nuclei, then considerably more processing would have to occur to turn that into water, to rocket fuel, et cetera. And so what we suggested in the report was made a list of a variety of technologies that would have to be developed in order to pursue this space exploration vision. And one of those was to make an assessment of resource potential. And so I don't see this in the near term being something that is very commercially viable. I think
right.
It's basic research.
Right.
So I think at least in the near term, it's going to be more in the province of the government.
Ella Garcia, where do you stand on all of this in this direction? What is your comment on it?
Well, I think, again, it goes back to some of the things I said earlier. I think it's that partnership idea. I mean, NASA can open up, you know, the vision for the future for a space-faring society.
Do you think Americans are ready for this kind of an effort? Or do we have to sell it to them all over again?
Well, I wanted to address it. I think that's fairly problematic. I mean, I think it's very hard in this country to try to engage in long-term policy planning, long-term program planning, because of our business cycles, electoral cycles. And the idea of trying to put forward a plan such as this Moon-Mars vision that's incremental in nature, pay-as-you-go, is good on one hand because it fits very well with the norm of our public policy, but on the other hand, it can also be a recipe for disaster because it can be very tied to parochial congressional interests. I mean, take, for example, both the shuttle and station were beset by incremental politics and very parochial interests, and we've seen what are some of the results of that. So I think it becomes very difficult. You know, how do you sustain the long-term political interests, long-term budgets in a society and culture that's really accustomed to short-term cycles, short-term gratification? I think it's not just a political question. I think it's also a cultural and societal question.
We're talking about the future of space this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. Let me ask you a question about commercialization and see if this fits in. There's a very interesting article in the May issue of Popular Science. Perhaps you've seen it. And it says, a modest PopSci proposal, turn the International Space Station into a $2 million a night space hotel. And they go and give, you know, a little bit of detail on how they might do that and how they might get European cooperation to do that. Elon Musk, could you work on something like that? Would that be, could you make rockets that could go up there and bring tourists and then they talk about staying there for days and having, you know, great hotel experience?
I think, you have to solve the transportation problem, and that's really what SpaceX is working on right now. And just to give you a little bit of background, we'll be launching our first orbital rocket later this year, carrying a Navy satellite, and then we'll be working on a larger vehicle, and then after that we'll be working on making the upper stage reusable, which would enable human transportation.
Mm-hmm.
But we really have to solve that transportation issue. As Maria alluded to earlier, that is really what's holding us back. There are not several problems in space. I think there is really one very primary problem, and that is the cost of getting there.
We're not talking an engineering problem. We're not talking. It's basically a science problem. We know how to do it. It's just the cost of who's going to pay for it.
Yeah, I think it's not. There's no silver bullet technology that's necessary to make this work. I think it is a question of applying sound engineering and sound business practices to reduce what is today an exorbitant amount to get to space to something which is more affordable, and then, as I mentioned earlier, to try to set it on a path of continuous cost improvement every year, as opposed to where it is today, which mm-hmm. it seems to get more expensive every year.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to Kurt in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, morning, Naya.
Hi there.
Morning, everybody. I guess my question goes back to what you were talking about a minute ago about long-term goals. It's not anything that's going to be relevant anytime soon, but just about regulation. If we're doing this privatized exploration into space, you know, who's going to regulate that? You know, it's been pretty obvious that private companies aren't able to regulate themselves in terms of pollution and such things, you know, here on Earth. So what's going to stop people, once we get over that hurdle of getting up there, just from taking over and expanding out? And another part of that is, you know, there's a lot of talk about America. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, space is kind of, you know, belongs to, you know, everybody and all over the planet. Why, I mean, is there any talk of any global effort to do this in kind of a concrete, together kind of way?
Dr. Sadeh?
Yeah, let me address that. I think, you know, first of all, in terms of the regulatory or legal environment, I mean, there is some legal environment out there. You clearly have the Outer Space Treaty and its regime that provides somewhat of an environment to regulate what's going on in space, or at least establish a peaceful use of space. And there's also then regulatory agencies, particularly in the United States, like the Federal Aviation Administration that regulates suborbital flight, for instance. They came out with a new licensing process for that. They regulate space launch. So there is a growing regulatory framework, and I think there's a recognition that clearly the private sector, commercial sector, and government need to work together to enhance and make that regulatory framework more robust and useful to foster space commerce. Dealing with your other question, I really think that the issue of cooperation is really kind of underplayed. And, you know, if you look at the Moon-Mars report, the commission's report, they don't really discuss cooperation that explicitly or really explain it all that much. And I would agree with you. I think it's a worldwide endeavor. I think for all its faults, the International Space Station has showed us that cooperation can be beneficial and can have benefits beyond just the space sphere. It can have, you know, tangible political benefits as well. So I think if we're going to pursue this, we should pursue it for humanity in a cooperative manner very substantially at the onset.
Okay, let me just... interrupt here because we have to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll come back, take lots more of your phone calls, talk lots more about the future of space. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto, and we're talking this hour about the role of private industry in space exploration, the reconfiguration of NASA, with my guests, Maria Zuber, head of the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences at MIT, Eligar Sadeh, assistant professor in the Space Studies Department at the University of North Dakota, and Elon Musk, he's chairman and CEO of SpaceX. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. I understand on the line phoning in is Greg Marinek, who's executive director of the XPRIZE. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira.
Do you have a question or a comment?
I have a comment. My comment is, yes, every time any airplane takes off any place on the planet, it's chock full of NASA and NASA's predecessors' technology. But there's not a living soul that expects the tail to say Air NASA. NASA doesn't operate planes. It doesn't even build planes. But it developed the technology that the private sector has used to create a $300 billion a year business. I think this new report by Dr. Zuber and Pete Aldridge is exactly right when they say we need a new partnership. We need to deal with space much as aviation evolved, and that's why we started the Ansari X Prize, to get teams from around the world to demonstrate that there's a market.
Well, let me bring that up because, you know, when Lindbergh made his crossing of the Atlantic and he won his prize, there was a real need to deliver the mail, to bring people, to go from city to city, commerce, industry, whatever, you know, it would take the place of a ship, of a train, of, you know, in cars. What is the motivation? What is the driving force? What demand will, you know, space industry satisfy?
Well, the first demand would be the demand that enabled Lindbergh to learn to fly and to make some money so that he survived later when he became an airmail pilot. Because when he learned to fly, there was no airmail. Mm-hmm. There was no commercial service. What he did was take people so they could see the Earth from the air. We might call it air tourism today. So the first market, and it's a multi-billion-dollar market, according to the Futron Corporation and studies all around the world, that's the first market. But that'll be followed by the space equivalent of airmail and ultra-rapid executive transport and eventually airline-like transport from one side of the planet to the other. And what we learn from doing those commercial markets will lower the cost of space so that we can use the resources of space to save our planet.
So if this is so evident to you, why is it so slow for industry to develop its own? You know, why is here we sit, you know, from the early days of the 60s when we had the first astronauts and cosmonauts, it's now over 40 years.
Because the governments were so successful at doing this that we got it in our heads that only governments can do this. Just like Elon said, when in the mainframe era of computing, everybody knew computers were, you know, multi-million dollar artifacts that took up a room. But
right.
When Jobs and Wozniak and the other fellows that created the personal computer revolution did so, then we got market forces that really enabled people to play in this, and we're now seeing the personal spaceflight revolution, at least the dawn of it. And that's the real significance of what Paul Allen and Bert Rutan did on Monday.
Are there other people, other players, and they get the most publicity because they're the first to do this, but are there others waiting in the wings like Elon Musk to do, you know, to get their share of the business?
There absolutely are. There are 26 teams in 7 countries that are registered to compete for the XPRIZE, and of those, about 6 are building flight-ready hardware. So watch, you know, nobody knew who Charles Lindbergh was. Everybody knew that Richard Byrd was going to win. So, you know, there could still be some surprises here. Stay tuned.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ira.
Greg Marinek, Executive Director of the XPRIZE, phoning in from St. Louis. My other guests this hour are Marie Zuber, Eligar Sadeh, and Elon Musk. Elon, do you share his enthusiasm?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think we're really going to see a lot more than people expect in the next 5 years. And I think, just as nobody really expected, if you had done a poll in the early 70s and said, how many people do you think are going to have a computer on their desk in 20 years, I think you would have probably gotten a result where people said, I don't think anyone's going to have a computer on their desk, or maybe 2% or 5%. And yet, certainly by the mid-90s, most people in their office had a computer, and I think mm-hmm. probably most people at home had one, too.
Mm-hmm. Marie Zuber, the commissioner, says that and I'll read from a little bit of the summary report, sustaining the long-term exploration of the solar system requires a robust space industry that will contribute to national economic growth, produce new products through the creation of new knowledge, and lead the world in invention and innovation. This space industry will become a national treasure. And it says that NASA can help foster this by reaching into commercial and nonprofit communities to, I guess, help stimulate this through contracts, perhaps. What prevents the 800-pound gorillas from the space industry, like the Lockheeds, the Boeing, the aerospace industry, those people like that, from sucking all the money up and preventing the Rutans and the Musks and the, you know, people like that from getting some entrepreneurial money?
Well, first of all, we made, if you look at what NASA does now, certainly it contracts with the commercial sector. But the experience has been that it contracts with the commercial sector mostly as vendors for parts and for subsystems, less so for services. And it struck us that there were opportunities for the private sector to become more involved than this. It certainly, I think, doesn't serve the cause of space exploration, nor does it serve the economic health of the country, which we're in part trying to stimulate in this space exploration vision by having just the largest companies participate in this. So we've actually suggested in our report a number of modern management practices that would go out and essentially look into the private sector for where the best values are. And one of the ideas that we came up with is a lead system integrator, which is someone who would be assigned to integrate the various components of specific parts of the vision. And certainly there would be a number of things that, you know, a Northrop or a Lockheed or a Boeing would be best at. But what you're looking for, the biggest innovations seem to occur in sort of the smallest companies. Mm-hmm. So it's really in the small companies where you get, you know, a few guys and gals in their garage with a terrific idea who come up with a great little product, you know, that eventually, you know, if they're very successful, will be bought up by one of the big guys. But there's certainly they're developing these things. And the idea of this system integrator would be to be reaching out in the community to look for these things. You know, there are certain things that NASA has asked for. But what if somebody has a great idea that would be useful that nobody thought to ask the question if they have it? And so we've tried to recommend, you know, setting up a system within NASA where they ask these questions. You know, if somebody has a great idea, what is the mechanism to go out and look for these ideas and especially into the small companies?
Eligar Sadeh, you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I think I think it is the right approach. I mean, one thing we need to consider is that, you know, today space commerce and the space industry, if you look at it from a commercial standpoint, is probably represents about 1% or less than 1% of our entire, you know, domestic output. So it's not all that significant. And I think to sustain the long-term vision, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, the problems in trying to sustain a long-term vision. But one way to do it is to get the industry involved and to make it a significant part of our economy. And when that happens, I think the sustainability then will be enhanced as well.
Elon Musk, do you need anything from the space agencies, or can you raise money and continue with your work without their help and possibly interference, as you might see it?
Well, I do think that there is an important role for government and for private enterprise, and in the manner, I think where government is really quite good is an infrastructure such as highways, railroads, that sort of thing, and then commerce can do most of the rest. But it's that sort of getting over that initial hump is really what's very difficult. I'm in the fortunate position of not, at least at this point, needing a whole lot of capital. I was the largest shareholder of PayPal when we sold it to eBay for $1.5 billion. So at least for some period of time, I don't have to raise capital. Space is certainly well out of the comfort zone of venture capitalists today. But hopefully if we can be successful at SpaceX, or if Bird can be successful or someone else, and can perhaps serve as the Netscape of the space industry to really get capital interested in the arena, I think that will be very important.
Interesting. We're talking about space this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is our number. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in before we have to go. Chuck in San Francisco. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Hi, everybody. First, I'd just like to say I think the achievement of Spaceship One is really very exciting and very cool. But you were talking a little earlier about colonization, and I think sometimes you hear people who are trying to sell space travel as something worth pursuing. Promoting this idea that we have to go to space, and I'm a little uncomfortable with that because it seems kind of anti-environmental in the sense that it suggests we're going to have a space program because we're going to just deplete our own planet so bad that we're going to have to go live on Mars. But anyway, and that gets me around to my question, really, which is I think a lot of the things that have been proposed as far as the commercial payoff of space travel seem kind of far-fetched to me. You know, I can see how tech development is worth doing, and, you know, tourism certainly would be fun. But, you know, sometimes you hear talk about things like giant solar cells or mining or I don't know what else. Mm-hmm. But so I guess that's my question.
Yeah,
commercial payback here?
Eligar Sadeh, is there money to be made mining the moon, for example, or any of the asteroids?
Well, short term, clearly not. I mean, clearly it's going to take, you know, government, you know, as Elon Musk mentioned, government opening up those frontiers, creating the infrastructure on the moon and Mars, creating the infrastructure in low Earth orbit and elsewhere. And once that infrastructure is created over the long term, let's say over the course of the 21st century, then you're going to have the basis for the commercial sector to go out there. Clearly the potential to make money is there. but it's really very much in the future. We need to start incremental. I mean, Spaceship One, the XPRIZE is a first step. It's going to open up, I think, space tourism within the next decade or so, and that's a beginning. And I think commerce will as well begin to take hold in terms of providing services and operations to NASA, particularly if the recommendations of the commission are taken to heart. So I think we're kind of at the beginning. We're kind of at what I would call setting the agenda for our future as a spacefaring society over the course of the 21st century. So it's something that, you know, it's not going to happen 5 or 10 years. It's a century out or centuries out. It's a very long-term endeavor.
And that's also actually a safe thing to say if you put the burden on someone else's generation to do it. And instead of saying, you know, as we did in the 60s, we're going to do the, you know, in 10 years, we're going to put a man on the moon and bring him home safely. Maria Zuber, is there any real timeline that your commission had laid down here for getting any of these things accomplished?
In any situation where you have a cost constraint, something has to give. And from the standpoint of the commission, the variable in this is time. The president directed that this vision be implemented using NASA's budget plus a small increment to that budget, most of which is, at least in the first couple of years, directed towards getting the shuttle operational again so that the space station can be completed. But we felt it was very important to be headed down the path of knowing where you were going. And then, you know, you would get the question, you know, in the congressional hearings, it was, well, what if there's a cost overrun on the crew exploration vehicle? And it's, you look at the budget that you have and use the budget that you have to move forward. And if something has to give, it's going to be the time towards implementation.
This is the pay-as-you-go concept.
That's exactly right. And, mining on the moon, I think that is very far out. However, the key to doing anything in space is routine access to low Earth orbit, and that is something that should be achievable in the nearer term. And it's something that the, you know, commercial sector can definitely help with.
All right. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank all of you. Maria Zuber, member of the President's Commission on Implementation of the U.S. Space Exploration Policy. She's also head of the department and E.A. Griswold Professor of Geophysics, Department of Earth Atmospheric Planetary Sciences at MIT. Thank you for being with us today. Eligar Sadeh, Assistant Professor in Space Studies Department, part of the Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences, University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. Thank you. And Elon Musk, he's Chairman and CEO of Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, SpaceX. They're based in El Segundo, California. Thank you for joining us today. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Charles Berquist, and Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Our intern is Erica Altman. And we had help this hour from engineer Tim Skog in Boston. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.